there. How you doing?
Hello, I am good. How are you?
Good. Well, welcome everyone to our podcast. Today we are going to be covering fitness tracker apps and all the ways in which they affect minority groups and all the theories we're going to apply to it as well.
How they're ableist.
Yep. We're going to also cover some fat phobia in society. We're going to cover, you know, data mining and self-surveillance and touch on minorities' distrust of health authorities.
Mm-hmm. As well, how they highlight the gender binary and inflame eating disorders and self-surveillance habits.
Yeah, we're gonna get into it. Do you wanna tell us when these fitness apps kind of came to fruition? Because I really can't say or really pinpoint when they came about.
Yeah. So it's actually a pretty recent thing. The App Store launched in 2008, which, if you think about it, is really not that long ago. And it wasn't until about 2 years after that that the very first fitness app was invented. It was an app called FitPhone, but it has since been erased from the market, so you cannot download the very first fitness app. But So about, I would say, 10 years ago is when the fitness app trend started.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, it's fascinating to know that they've only been around for a short period, but they've kind of taken over our lives in so many ways and influenced the mainstream a lot too. Like, I constantly see, if not Apple Watches and Fitbits, but I also just know of all the girls my age that were using, you know, MyFitnessPal in high school and still are to this day, you know, some to their detriment. Mm-hmm. We also wanted to kind of touch on Foucault's panopticon metaphor, you know, with the aspects of the self-surveillance that's constantly happening, but also kind of sharing with friends and, you know, having that competitiveness as well, like, you know, constantly being watched, but ironically by this thing in your phone that you don't really even realize is watching you all the time, right? It's quite passive the way it happens. But I think surveillance is really tied into a lot of what we're going to be talking about and, you know, how to be that upstanding member of society in the best way, which is also, of course, where biopedagogies and stuff fit in. But I feel like we should just kind of get into it.
So I did some research to see how fitness apps might highlight the gender binary in an unnecessary way. And I did find a couple problematic features, especially regarding MyFitnessPal. For one, they do not allow for a gender-neutral option because you have to give the app a bunch of information. And one of them is your gender and also your height, your weight, stuff like that. And it doesn't allow for a gender neutral option. And that's pretty key because the app then goes and makes recommendations and nutrition plans and workout plans dependent on your gender. Fitbit is also another one that does not allow for gendered variation. I did find, however, just so that we're not super negative, there is an app called Lose It that does allow for a non-binary or prefer not to say option. But there is no trans option.
Interesting.
Overall, they're not adaptable enough for the variety of bodies that live in our society. It's very mainstream focused. It doesn't really have room for adaptability, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting for something that's so prominent in our society now to still have those kinds of accessibility issues and not be conscious of all the different types of representation there is out there for gender. Like, it's pretty sad.
And also, like, I mean, I am a woman, so I have experienced MyFitnessPal through, you know, the lens of a woman, and I found that a lot of the recommendations that they were giving me were very gendered, just like in the workouts that they would suggest me to do. They're just
right.
I feel like the fitness world in general has a blatant divide between the sexes, the genders, that it's mm-hmm. so unnecessary. Like, you won't see a boy doing floor workouts where they're doing the fire hydrant.
Totally.
For some reason, society has decided that that's a girl thing. Yeah. And I don't know. I think that that's just one of the many factors that adds to maybe the essentialism, you know?
Well, yeah, it's even there's physical divides in the gyms as well, right? Like, you have the women's side and the men's side for very good reasons. But, like, this divisiveness carries on in the fitness world in so many different ways, so many different facets. Mm-hmm. So yeah, definitely touches on essentialism. It's interesting. I didn't realize that they had such limited options. So it's pretty disheartening, but hopefully there'll be some changes in the future for that. I mean, one can hope. But yeah, I guess I'm gonna segue without really segueing because it's not related at all, but I'm gonna segue into the kind of ideal body, but also, you know, this notion of health in a fat phobic society and like what that looks like. I actually found a study that was done, and it was looking at kind of younger people's use of like Fitbits and, you know, self-surveillance through that. And yeah, it was really interesting. There's this big association that healthy behavior and health equates to like 10,000 steps a day. Like that's that, you know, point where everyone has kind of mutually agreed, like, I'm healthy if I achieve this. And so it's interesting how they've just kind of related health and fitness to being fit, right? So it's like, it's less so of like, health is, you know, taking care of your body and being kind to yourself and nourishing your body. It's like achieving these goals that can be really hard sometimes. And, you know, it's unfortunate to set those kinds of, you know, points for yourself to reach those kind of goals. If you're having a busy day or if, you know, you weren't able to walk around as much, like then you have this guilt enter, right? And that's, as we know, that's not healthy. Like it's all consuming.
It sets a standard for everyone when everyone's not the same. Everyone can't meet the requirements that these apps set out for people.
Exactly. And, you know, it's, you know, also you've got the, you know, it's the biopedagogy as well, right? It's like informing the social body now that this is the standard and this is what you should be achieving. And if you're not achieving this, you're not your ideal optimized self, which is also super detrimental, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because you have these kids now and they're sharing their data with each other. So not only, you know, are the big companies taking the data, but they're sharing the data with each other. And there's that competitiveness that happens, you know, and it's like self-surveillance, but also you're surveying everyone else at the same time, which is further informing that social body, you know. It's this technology that's meant to make things easier, and it can end up being consuming, right? And there's, you know, throughout the article as well, it's this notion of, well, one, that, you know, the narrow interpretation that, you know, health means not being fat, which is super problematic because everyone's body is different. You know, we've idealized this thin body type. You know, obviously there's different changes now with like slim thick, but overall, right, like this is what we have decided as a whole, and we're sticking to that, right? And, you know, calorie consumption comes into that as well. You know, you're tracking your calories on these apps too. So it's exhausting. It's a full-time job, you know? It's a full-time job to reach this standard that is so idealized in our fat-phobic society. Like, it's really sad.
It really is a full-time job. I agree with that. And I think because it's such a big thing, a lot of people, like, I know for me especially, I just avoid fitness and the gym and all that as a whole.
Yeah.
Because the standard is so high and it's intimidating. So I think that also that like intense competition breeds an overall unhealthy population, because who wants to even try if you're not going to be this perfect thin, you know, body type?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And then you have like, you know, particularly in America, and I found, you know, this in another article that was called, you know, Fat Phobia and the Importance of Confronting Our Own Stigma. And, you know, society already is treating, you know, fat people very poorly, and they're dictating how they should work out, how they should eat, what is healthy. Like their idea of health informed through the social body is pushed onto these people, right? So on one hand, the apps could be better in a way for these people because they can, you know, take their health in their own hands and they can do it behind closed doors where they feel comfortable. They don't have people coming up to them at the gym or people suggesting things. But then at the same time, like that's so sad, you know, that it's, you know, you're having to go behind those closed doors. So it's kind of a double-edged sword there, but it's, you know, it's so prevalent in society still. And, you know, we preach this body positivity when really it should be body acceptance, first of all. And, you know, it's even worse for women because we're supposed to be small and take up less space, right?
And that feeds into so many other things.
Yeah.
Just like, yeah, the burden of being a woman, really.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it's, you know, America has this long history of pushing that narrative, you know, Canada too, but, you know, I mean, Western culture as a whole, but pushing this narrative to be thinner. And, you know, they get to prey on our insecurities this way, and that's how they sell us products, right? And so these apps are no different.
Oh, yeah.
They're no different. This narrative in society is pushed onto us, and then so are these apps subsequently, and it's exhausting.
It's genius. It really is. On the side of the producers of,
oh, yeah,
of these apps, definitely, because they're feeding, yeah,
yeah,
off of fear.
Let's call it what it is, patriarchy.
Yeah, yeah. They're feeding off of fear and insecurity, which I feel like is such a powerful tool.
Yeah, and they're packaging it as health. This is health. This is what health looks like. This is what health doesn't look like, and that's not true.
Mm-hmm. So we also wanted to talk about how these apps are not created for everybody, right?
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily obvious. So we gotta add a lens of intersectionality here and think about how, you know, different bodies would be experiencing these apps. So for example, people with disabilities, fitness is already going to be a little more difficult.
Yeah.
So I wanted to see straight from the source. I didn't want to just, you know, assume, because I am an able-bodied person. So I looked up some reviews specifically for MyFitnessPal on how they treated disabled bodies. And I found a lot. I found a lot of negative reviews.
I could imagine, yeah.
I found this person. Their username is ChannyPhil1967. They are a disabled person who uses a wheelchair, and they found that it's very hard to fit the amount of calories required into their day that the app suggests. And they said, plus, when I work out and burn calories, you add more, which often means I am under my calorie goal. So what they're basically saying is, because they're not as mobile as the app assumes they are,
mm-hmm,
they're not burning the calories that it assumes it should be. They should be burning.
So they're, it's telling them that they need to burn more calories or less.
Yeah, more calories.
Oh, right. Okay.
Because they're not burning calories from, let's say, walking.
Right.
Or something like that.
That's messed up.
Yeah. And there's a reply section where a lot of these, and I suppose these aren't necessarily reliable sources because they're just other users of the apps.
Mm-hmm.
But these people's opinions are all kind of the same. And there was another commenter who said that he's completely immobile and he's just wondering how to lose weight. Like, so his goal is to lose weight. So from the commenter's perspective, and you can absolutely see this through what the app provides for people with disability, which is zilch, nada, nothing. So you can see that reflected in the comments, because they'll say, you basically have to disregard the exercising portion altogether, that, wow, there are no exercises that can accommodate for a disabled body at all, and that they just need to focus on weight loss and restricting their calories and working towards a calorie deficit.
What?
So they're basically just saying,
that's dangerous.
Looks like you don't get the privilege of exercising and keeping your strength up in certain areas that are still mobile. You just have to focus on what you're eating and the calories that you're burning.
Just restriction.
Yeah.
Wow.
So they're basically saying that there is no solution. It's obvious that these are not accommodating for people,
yeah,
with disability. I don't think that's a question.
Yeah, it doesn't accommodate them. You're right. It's very clear you're not welcome here. This isn't for you. You don't get to have this.
Exactly.
Even though they can have this, you just need to put a little bit more effort in as a developer,
yeah,
to make sure that it's inclusive. So
yeah, on the side of the developer, they need to do more research on how to accommodate for people with disabilities in the fitness world.
Absolutely. It's just so easy to get away with ableism. Like, it's so easy to not make the effort to make things more accessible, whether that's in the physical world, whether that's, you know, online. It's so easy because I think people are able to kind of be like, oh, well, you know, it's just a small minority of people. You know, the general population is generally pretty mobile. It's not fair. It's, you know, but they get away with it because of that mentality and because there's that lack of accountability. I kind of like that this is an online facet, because you have these message, you know, these comment sections where people can voice these concerns and, you know, more people can see them. So, but then, once again, it's not the responsibility of the person with a disability to be teaching, you know, it's standpoint theory in a way, I guess. It's not their responsibility to be teaching the people that are making the stuff. But I was wondering too, it's like a lot of these apps are really focused on steps. So like, what if you're in a wheelchair?
Ah, yes. Okay. So there are some apps that accommodate for this.
Okay.
So Apple Watch has actually been really good for people with wheelchairs. I found a lot of reviews hyping them up, because I guess the way that the app works is it can sense the different terrain that someone is wheeling on.
Right.
So they take that into account for calorie burning, because you're going to be burning more calories if you're on grass than you are on asphalt.
Okay.
So, and I think that's really cool. But, you know, Fitbit doesn't have that. It tracks everything. It tracks your heart rate, your sleep, your steps, your calories, and your exercise.
So I guess all of this is really, like, what would you say, like, critical disability theory?
Yeah. It's taking a standard practice and noticing the absolute flaws from the perspective of a person with a disability. Because an able-bodied person, you know, you usually don't notice all of these things because they're created for you, around you. They work for you.
It's constant closed doors for people, right? It's the physical closed doors that don't have the automatic push button. And then it's the closed door in every facet of every technology, of every aspect of life. It's just, it's nonstop. And it's, I honestly can't imagine what it's like to be, I mean, I have my own mental disabilities, plenty of those, but I can't imagine what it would be like to be physically disabled and have to navigate all of these situations. And then to have this app where you're like, cool, accessibility. And even the app is like, no, sorry, you know, you're not, you're going to get a sliver, if anything, of what everyone else gets. Like, it sucks. It's shit. It's 2021. Come on.
Yeah.
Depressing stuff. So let me get on to some more depressing stuff here. So I'm going to go into a little bit of the data mining, data, whatever. And self-surveillance, because obviously that's pretty much one of the more prevalent themes, I think, with any sort of tracking app. If it's an MFTA or if it's, you know, the fitness tracking app, it's kind of scary. So just, to kind of give a little bit of, you know, background information on, you know, biopedagogies and surveillance, I did want to reference a bit from the Gender, Sex, and Tech, an Intersectional Feminist Guide, particularly Poulter et al.'s chapter on MFTAs. I mean, essentially, these fitness apps are biopedagogies because by surveying, you know, our own bodies and collecting data, we are simultaneously informing how the social body should look and should be. I have a little quote here from said chapter. Biopedagogies do not aim to cultivate just anybody. Rather, biopedagogies generate and convey knowledge, competencies, skills, and moral codes, which define what the body is and ought to be, whose and what bodies have status and value, which, you know, references back to the ideal body type in our society and what body work needs to be done to make one's body fit, you know, which we've also kind of figured out that fit means, you know, skinny. This is, you know, the consensus, sadly.
The standard, yeah.
But, you know, like, as, you know, as I mentioned, this self-surveillance, it becomes a full-time job, even though you don't notice you're doing it per se, especially if you've got, you know, the Fitbit on or the Apple Watch or, you know, what have you, rather than having to constantly input the information. It's a bit sinister that way because it's like you don't, you're not even noticing it happening. And then you also don't know what's happening with the data. Like, you have no idea what they're using it for. And, you know, as, you know, we kind of discussed in class, like, before it was this fear of the government having your data, but, like, now it's self-surveillance capitalism and it's, you know, our data is a commodity and our privacy is a commodity. So, you know, it's really disheartening to see how easily this stuff is being shared and how, you know, the lack of transparency that comes along with that. And if it's not being taken from you in more like insidious ways, then it's the constant work of inputting what you've eaten, how, what your workout was, you know, all this stuff every single day, you know, like that's exhausting. It is like a full-time job. And for what?
You're datafying yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like this is wild. This is wild. Like you don't have enough to do in your day. Like you don't have enough to do in your day. You still are going to be doing all this on the side, you know, and like contributing to these, you know, social body standards. And, you know, it's sad. And I wouldn't say that it is feminist. Like, I think, you know, working out is obviously empowering if you want to be strong and healthy. But for so long, the connotation of health was this skinny frame, this skinny ideal body. So like, I don't think that's feminist to be putting your information into an app all day, every day, to be so exhausted doing that. Because what is your end goal here? You know what I mean? Like, it's a bit murky. I don't know.
It's also, I feel like maybe in a way, taking away from some sort of freedom that you might have had.
Yeah.
That you no longer have because you're giving all this personal information away to these apps and these corporations. Yeah. Like you said, who knows what they're doing with that information?
Totally. And capitalism cannot be feminist.
Absolutely.
Because it's exploitation. And it's a lot of exploitation of women and women's roles and the unseen labor, right? So the surveillance capitalism, you know, this is what this is, right? It's But it was actually interesting because, you know, I did have these two studies. You know, I had the first study, which was the young people's use of wearable healthy lifestyle technologies, self-surveillance and resistance by Goodyear et al. And, you know, that was interesting to read because I feel like kids have, or like younger people have more an awareness of, you know, where data is going and sometimes less of a care about it, sure. But a lot of the people in the study got to a point where, you know, it affected, negatively affected their well-being and they got into these unhealthy habits because they were sharing the data with friends, they got competitive, they were constantly tracking, and it can lead to, you know, very extreme weight loss. And so they're under this like constant gaze. They're under this constant gaze all the time, which is the app, which is the biopedagogy, you know, they're inputting, it's informing, it's this like endless sick cycle packaged as health. You know, I have this other quote from that article. It said, through the device and app, young people potentially become subjects of both the normalizing gaze of health as well as their own self-surveillance of who to become. Which, you know, is biopedagogy, but, you know, I bet we could talk to a bunch of kids, they wouldn't even realize this, you know? Because nobody tells you this. You don't have an awareness of this and what it means.
How is the average person to know better, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing, right? Like, we need to be informed, but they're not going to inform us because they lose if they inform us. But one more thing I want to touch on before we turn over to you was, it was actually interesting because I found another study of older adults. And it was called The Use of Wearables and Health Apps and the Willingness to Share Self-Collected Data Among Older Adults. And actually, after surveying older adults, they found that a lot of them were actually quite okay, you know, with their data being shared, particularly if it was for health insurance purposes or for like research institutions or just healthcare in general. And I thought that was really interesting because we always have this stereotype that older people are really afraid of, you know, their data being shared. But I guess you see here now that it's more maybe like privacy concerns rather than their health information, but I guess also perhaps they don't know
where it's going,
you know, what that means, because how would they, right? I also read on WebMD that they did a really thorough analysis and there was really serious and inconsistent privacy practices with health apps, you know, and about 88% of health apps could potentially have access and share that data, which is scary and very unknown. So this is why I'm kind of thinking, you know, older adults are okay with that data being shared because they don't really understand the repercussions of it. So yeah, I don't know. It's just a constant, exhausting, self-surveying thing in so many different ways. And just, yeah, just very consuming. Consuming is the perfect word to describe it. Back to you.
So I guess to pick off of, like, your points on biopedagogy and the self-surveying would be my final note about how, you know, these apps, they might not necessarily be the main cause because there's a million causes for why disordered habits come about. But I definitely think that these apps inflame disordered habits, particularly eating disorders. There's a plethora of eating disorders, you know, anorexia. But there's also an eating disorder where just vigilantly tracking your food intake and your exercise intake and like basically datifying yourself is a disorder.
It's packaged under health, right? Yeah. It's like healthy eating, but it's an eating disorder.
Yeah, exactly.
Just so messed up.
Exactly. So I found a couple articles on this. There was an article about text mining that said fitness tracking tech can be defined as devices that enable the self-monitoring of one's physical activity, such as calorie expenditure, which is exactly what we said. It's, you know, self-tracking. So these articles that I'm pulling from, they were mainly critiquing MyFitnessPal, which is something that I have personal experience with as well. So this works for me. So they did a study and they found that a majority of recently discharged eating disordered patients have indicated that they used MyFitnessPal and viewed it as contributing to their eating disorders.
Oh.
And so according to this article, they found that the most mentioned fitness tracking apps used by people with eating disorders are MyFitnessPal, Fitbit, and Heart Rate Monitor.
Oh, interesting.
So those are the three main ones that I found that contributed. And now that could just be because they're the most well-known. Or it could be because those apps specifically have negative aspects. So they did a study and they found that 75% of the participants who have eating disorders reported that they use the app, and 73% say it contributed to their eating disorder.
Wow. Staggering.
Yeah. So I guess it's not a question of whether these apps do contribute to eating disorders. I think that's out of the question. I think absolutely they do.
Yeah.
But I also think they create disordered habits. Like, it's the tracking itself is, yeah, the self-tracking is disordered thinking to begin with.
Well, it's also the conversation that no one wants to have. Like, gym bros have eating disorders.
Oh, yeah.
No one wants to talk about it, but, like, any form of this, like, micromanagement of every... That is an eating disorder. It's disordered eating.
Fasting?
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Yeah, no one likes to admit that. I mean, I know that fasting is a genuine thing for, like, religious purposes. I know that.
Yes, yes.
But,
yes.
Yeah, the people have taken fasting into a whole new genre and...
Oh, yeah.
Labeled it as health, and it's not health.
Well, it's recommended, because I know I fasted when I had an eating disorder, because I was like, my eating disorder is gone, but I'm fasting now.
Exactly.
And I would be reading about how to do it in the best way, as you do when you have an eating disorder, and it would... Every website says, if you have an eating disorder... Do not do fasting. And so why do these apps not have that disclaimer?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's chicken and the egg, right? What came first, I guess.
That's true.
Yeah.
And like I said before, so these apps allow you to input personal information about yourself, and then they make recommendations based on those attributes that you've indicated. So right there, when it makes recommendations, it's assuming that you're like, this is where you're going to be in 6 months. And when you don't fulfill those expectations, you know, then you just feel like you're a failure, I suppose.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as we know, life happens and it's not sustainable to constantly doing these things sometimes, but that impacts how you feel about yourself.
And these weight loss norms, you know, they're based off of the standardized body, but they don't take into account just disordered thinking. It's really, and here's the funny thing. And we've discussed this in class, as well. You're basically the producer and the consumer. So
yeah.
You're the prosumer in this case.
Yep.
So you're really contributing to your own demise, you know, and these apps don't look out for that. And they also, so I'll speak from personal experience. When I use MyFitnessPal, I logged everything and I took progress pictures and what I was eating in a day. And it would tell me, you know, the calories that I should be making up or taking away, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it had all my information to the best of its ability, my height, my age.
Yeah.
There should be a portion of the app that flags disordered habits.
Totally. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I didn't even think about that.
Because
yeah,
I had a disordered habit. And
it should check in with you.
It had all the information and it did nothing.
Instead, it celebrates you. You're on target.
Oh, you're 500 calories less than your goal. Good job. Like, yeah.
That's so dark. That's so dark.
Absolutely crazy.
I mean, but as is this underbelly of womanhood and achieving these impossible standards, it's this constant suffering behind closed doors. It's the counting calories. It's the body checks in the mirror. It's the wearing extra layers when you're on the treadmill. It's this unseen killing yourself to be perfect, and the app goes hand in hand with that narrative.
Yeah. And like you were saying before, like comparing yourself. So for fitness apps to be competitive, they started adding nutrition plans and they started creating a community base so that you could invite your friends, right? So I understand that from a marketing perspective, but that also created an online space for comparing yourself.
So pro Anna Tumblr, but <Yeah. laughs> make it fitness apps. Cool.
Yeah. So it allowed for comparing, and then it shows pictures of body goals and...
Stop.
There are pages for that.
Ew.
And like, I guess you could, you know, just not look.
Ew, no.
But it just... yeah.
I mean, Instagram is basically that, but like this shouldn't be associated with an app. Like there's already such a competitiveness fostered between women. Like
it's really just, it's self-surveying, which is unhealthy. And it's basically in the sense of essentialism, it's telling you how your body should be, how your body should work, what you should be losing by doing this. And so then when you don't, you are now...
You're a failure.
Yeah, you're a failure. You're now, something's wrong with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like maybe, like I said, in terms of my ableist point, you know, if these apps had a variety of information that you could input, even though that's, I guess, furthering the datifying of yourself.
Yeah.
It can also help create a specified, you know, plan for you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And hopefully dissipate the standardized body, because there is no standardized body. Also, I will say that all the workouts and the videos that it recommends...
Yeah.
All skinny people, no plus size people working out and showing you how to do things.
No, because that's not the end goal.
No, exactly.
Yeah. which is, well, yeah, exactly. And how can you possibly ever say that this doesn't encourage eating disorders if this ideal body type that they're pushing, this after body, quote, quote, is very skinny and fit and unattainable? Mm. It's not celebrating everyone. Not everyone can even get to that. Not everyone has that structure. Like, it's BS.
And, like, with my friend with PCOS, yeah. Like, she is the healthiest person I know.
Yeah.
But because of, you know, main media, whatever,
yeah,
people would assume that she's not.
Yeah. Super unfortunate. And it's super scary that I'm thinking now, like, how young are the girls that are starting to use this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no age.
You know, anyone can download it. Yeah. So everyone has an iPhone. So are 12-year-old girls starting this? That breaks my heart. All right. Well, to wrap things up, my last point here, I'm going to be talking about, I'm going to be touching on critical race theory. And, you know, the reason for that is, you know, first I want to cover, you know, the mistreatment of minorities, people of color, especially black people in healthcare, because, you know, there's a long history. And, you know, you can see this today, actually, with vaccine hesitancy and how it's happening a lot in black communities, which is super valid. You know, I found an article on the University of Nevada's website, and executive director of the Center of Health Disparities Research, Melva Thompson Robinson, kind of touches on, you know, past mistreatment. You know, if that was J. Marion Sims, you know, the man credited as, you know, the father of gynecology, who was performing.
I love that a man is for gynecology.
yeah. So we had, yeah. So J. Marion Sims, he was the father of gynecology. He did all of his work on slavery. And, you know, back then, African-American women had no rights. They weren't seen as people. So, you know, he wasn't using any anesthesia. Then we have, you know, the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, where they were, you know, researchers were willingly giving syphilis to African-American men and then withholding treatment, and they were dying. Like, these were very real things. This is, you know, it wasn't that long ago. You know, it's a part of our history, you know, not ours, America's, but, you know, that happened here with, you know, indigenous people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's healthcare has not been a safe place for people of color. And so I very much understand why they do have a mistrust of health authorities to this day. Why would you believe anyone in that position? Like, that doesn't even make sense. That's unsafe, you know. We also have, like, Henrietta Lacks, who is an African-American woman, and, you know, she thought she was being treated for cervical cancer, but they let her die, and then instead they were, you know, taking her cells and using them for cancer research study. Like, there's these countless examples, but because of that, there is that fear of, you know, health authorities. And so I was kind of thinking, you know, like, with the fitness apps, is that maybe a good thing, a good way for minorities to take their, you know, health into their own hands, because they know they're not biased. They know that they're not going to be skewing their own data, which is something that happens. You know, I found another article about, you know, implementing critical race theory in the field of public health, because by doing so, you know, it helps these professionals to examine their biases, you know, and it kind of brings a conceptual framework to, you know, racism in healthcare, especially inequalities and inequity, right? And, you know, how there's a lot of, like, data that can be looked at through a racist lens, you know, it can promote, as the article states, white supremacist ideologies. And, you know, eugenics was inspired by this as well, right? So kind of implementing that critical race theory could maybe change that eventually. But, like, it's still there. These biases still exist, even though maybe this horrible mistreatment that happened back then isn't happening as much, although black women do die in childbirth at a substantially higher rate. So it is still happening. You know, marginalized communities are catching COVID more because they have less resources, because they're, you know, tightly packed, all of these things. So it is still very real. So yeah, I don't know. I was just kind of going through all this and thinking, like, we have all these negatives about the fitness app, rightfully so, but, like, maybe perhaps in this instance, it could be a positive thing, you know, and it's a way to collect your own data and not have it misconstrued, not have it looked in through a lens that doesn't benefit you, that harms you. Because the apps, you know, they're recognized to be convenient. It's access, it's low cost, you know, it's, you know, you have access when maybe you don't have so much time, because minorities have to work longer hours, they have to work harder. So maybe they can't go to the gym, maybe they can't afford trainers. So, like, maybe in this one instance, it could be a positive thing. You know, maybe the benefits here could outweigh a lot of the negatives to some extent for certain communities, right? Like, I don't know. I just thought it would be kind of maybe helpful to look at it in one positive light, you know, in spite of all the negatives, and apply a bit of, you know, critical race theory and kind of see, well, maybe this is a good thing for them, and maybe this helps them take control in that accessible way that they don't have in society.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that maybe their ability to track their own bodies could, you know, potentially help them if, let's say, they do end up having to go to the doctor for something? They could use that solid information to show them, because they've been tracking their own nutrition and health, and that could help them be believed.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Because I feel like a lot of the times, like women as well as people with color, their voices are usually silenced. Mm-hmm. In the medical field. And so to be able to show this hard data where nothing can be like construed or
absolutely
misinterpreted by the medical field. I mean,
no, I'm glad you said that, because it's true. I mean, of course, women fit into that minority category, and there are the biases in healthcare for women as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, having this, you know, substantial evidence like this, you know, same with, I feel like also MFTAs in this instance, like this is, you know, my hormonal health, having that clear picture. Yeah, I think it could be tremendously beneficial and I think empowering as well. And I also feel like a lot of minorities are shamed for their bodies, for their existence, for taking up space, for how they are, their essence, you know. And I feel like getting back in touch with your body in that way, through that tracking, maybe that's also something that could be beneficial, learning more about yourself and how you are, you know. That maybe could also be a good, could also make it worse.
Yeah, we've definitely talked about the ways that can make it worse,
but you know, just that sense of control and power that they don't have in real life, because we live in a patriarchal white supremacist society still. To this day. So, you know, getting some of that power back, I feel like it's necessary.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So kind of a darker end, but also, you know, hopefully maybe, you know, this has potential to, you know, be a helpful tool for minority groups. So I guess I was just going to wonder, yeah, like what's your final like opinion on it? I know you've used them before. I know you don't use them anymore. Like, how was your experience? What was your biggest takeaway from using them?
From my personal experience, I would advise against using them. Mm-hmm. I think to track yourself like that in such a personal way, it's really unhealthy.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm sure there are people that are completely fine and they don't exhibit unhealthy patterns when they use them, but from my experience, and just like bringing back to your example of the Panoptagon, if someone is watching you constantly, yeah, not only will that, you know, affect the way that you're acting, but also that just like raises your stress levels.
Yeah.
And like, we all know stress and how it relates to health, and
yeah,
it's a huge factor.
Well, yeah, you're trying to be healthy, but you're making yourself more stressed out, which has actually negative impacts on mm-hmm. weight loss and health. Mm-hmm.
Stress clings to your fat. It doesn't let go of your fat, because that's, it needs energy. It needs, and fat is energy.
Totally.
So yeah, the datifying of human beings, I think, is problematic at best.
Yeah.
Crazy harmful at worst.
Yeah, because it's sinister. You're being tracked all of the time, but this instance is being packaged to you as,
yeah,
this is good for you, this is helping you, but it's they're just still making money off of you. Like, you can't escape it.
Yeah, and then it just fosters like an idea of failure when you don't meet those expectations. And through a capitalist society, you know, we're taught to be the best in every field.
Yeah.
We need to be successful all the time to be a good adult. And that feeds into everything too, mm-hmm. like your career, how much money you make, whatever. But your body and how you treat it, that also is a form of success now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, with like fat phobia, the ideal body image, if you are a larger person from the outside, because we're visual creatures, mm-hmm. you are seen through a capitalist lens as unsuccessful.
Absolutely. Which is so sad.
Yeah.
We're just a bunch of meat sacks at the end of the day. Like,
I know, we're all on a floating rock. Just chill.
Yeah, I mean, I've used them in the past too. I will say the food tracking, I mean, I had bulimia. I didn't have anorexia, so I was never that good that I would be like, not good, but I was never like, I wasn't a good anorexic. No, but I wasn't. I wasn't that person that was like obsessively tracking food per se. But I mean, when I did recover from bulimia, like I got really obsessive with health. Like I would stay at the gym until I burned 2,000 calories 5 days a week. Oof. I would be on the Stairmaster with a flu, like fainting.
Yeah.
You know, but in my head, it's like, oh, no, I don't have an eating disorder anymore because I'm working out now. But that's when those apps became dangerous for me. And I did get a Fitbit about last year. My stepmom gave me her old one and I had to give it back to her after like a week because I noticed that if I wasn't hitting those steps, like I would walk around my house or the neighborhood until I did. It was you cannot listen. If you have a history of disordered eating, you lose your privilege to use anything that tracks your health or your food. Mm-hmm. That's just my final stance. You lose that privilege because it's if it doesn't cause it, it enables it. And I know I'm not allowed to do that. I know I'm not allowed to get on machines that track my calories anymore. I know that I'm not allowed to track my own calorie. Like I know that.
Yeah.
I know that now. And so it makes me really sad that there aren't warnings on these apps that, I mean, the producers need to take responsibility of that. Because like I said, I'm picturing that 12-year-old girl in her room, like measuring her thighs with, you know, bloody like measuring tape and then, you know, going for walks at the end of the night to hit those steps. And that makes me feel so sad.
Yeah.
So sad to my core, you know. So yeah, it's yeah, that the constant surveillance, you know, the data mining, this, you know, fat phobia, all of it. It's just gross. And it's gross that, you know, these apps are packaged in a way that is empowering and good for you because that's bullshit.
Yeah, absolutely. I had to get rid of my scale. The only scale in my house is in my parents' bathroom and I'm not allowed to go in there.
Smart.
Like,
smart. It's about how you feel at the end of the day. I think that should be this. Listen, at the end of the day, it's about how you feel, right? And it's an intuitiveness. And the app goes completely against that because the app cannot tell you how you feel.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah.
Mic drop. I'm out.
Yeah, I definitely think there needs, and I'm sure there are already apps made through, you know, a more feminist lens.
Right.
Perhaps they should be more popular, but
yeah.
At the end of the day, I don't think apps need to glorify an image.
Yes.
They need to promote strength and healthy breathing, maybe. Things that aren't connected to something problematic, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'd love to see that one day. I'd love to see something that's based in more of a mindfulness and, you know, if anything health related, just tracking like physiological things, heart rate, you know, anything not connected to weight, not equating health with weight is what I would like to see. Pushing people to just go out and get some exercise for well-being, but not tracking everything to be competitive. Mm-hmm. That to me, I don't know if that exists. I haven't seen it, but that to me, I would use that if I was ever to use anything again. But yeah, just completely flipping the notion of health on its head is important.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, because at this point, it's anti-feminist and it's contributing to surveillance capitalism and it's all these bad things packaged in one neatly designed app. And yeah, it's time for that to die. Mm-hmm.
Like, the average person might be fine with giving their information to these data companies. And I definitely know, like, before I even heard about surveillance capitalism, I was fine with it. I was like, I don't care. It's not hurting me. I don't care. But these companies, you know, you don't know actually what these companies support.
Yeah.
They're making money off of your data. Let's say you're a vegan. I don't know. Just for an example. Then you're giving your data to these companies. You're basically giving, like, helping them make money, and then they're going off,
yeah,
and they're murdering a bunch of chickens, or they're using the money to murder a bunch of chickens.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you don't know, you could literally be supporting something that you, to your core,
yeah,
disagree with and don't believe in.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's the thing with data mining, like, you genuinely don't know where it's going.
I think at the end of the day, what we're both kind of touching on without really saying it, it's like a need for awareness in all aspects, like awareness of what you're using, awareness of where your information is going, awareness of your patterns and addictive behaviors, awareness of what the notion of health is and what that means, awareness of all the harmful, you know, all the stigma, all the oppression, everything that it's perpetuating through the use of these apps. It's just, is taking a critical lens to it, right? And, you know, if you want to keep using them, that's fine. But you need to have that awareness. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're not being ethical.
Yeah. And awareness of who is actually able to use the apps and who is not.
Yes.
So you also need to recognize your privilege.
Yes, absolutely.
Because we all have privilege.
Absolutely. Awesome. Well, it was great chatting with you about this stuff. It's super fascinating. And I loved all your takes.
Oh, thank you. You're very well put. Very articulate, I must say.
It's because I had matcha instead of coffee, so I'm not super anxious, just energy.
Should have had some tea.
We know for next time. All right, well, I hope our listeners have a great rest of their day.
Thank you for sitting down and taking your time and listening to us have opinions.
Yeah, thanks everyone. Take care.